Okay. The question this week is, how do you promote your poetry and put yourself out there without going insane?
So here's what I want to say. And I would say it, except that I know it's not true, but I'm going to say it anyways. And it's that the sole job of a poet should be writing the best poems they can. Now, for all the reasons we've already talked about in other episodes, that doesn't work. But I am a little bit, more than a little bit, hung up on the idea that that should be true. So I need your help getting past that entirely unhelpful idea that I have in my head.
So you disagree with the question in this week?
No, I don't, because again, I know the thing that I want to be true isn't. I think it is. Well, it's obviously a live question for me because I have a book coming out next year. So I think it's a necessary question. I just hate it.
Yeah, I don't know many poets who love this side of things, although there are poets who are very good at it, and I wonder if they actually enjoy it. The first thing I want to do is walk back something I said maybe 5-odd episodes ago, because as we're recording these slowly over sort of 4 or 5 months, I'm editing them and then we're having the conversations sort of at the same time. And I'm noticing things that I say where I'm like, oh, well, that's not true. Or you took that statement too far. And one of the things that I said earlier was that I'm not on social media. Social media, never met her, nothing to do with it, never touch the stuff. That's not true. That's like patently not true. So what I'm on at the moment is Substack, which is a social media platform. Like 100% it's a social media platform. And I am on there. I am looking at stuff. I don't know why I didn't think that counted, but it absolutely does count. It's doing the exact same thing to my brain that Twitter did back when I, like, for the very short period of time that I had Twitter and I was making Poetry Says, it was only a short window where I was trying to use Twitter to promote the show. But I one day just had a freak out and just like killed the whole thing. And I really thought that when I got off that platform, there would be some huge detrimental effect on the listenership to the show. I'm talking mostly about like podcast promotion, but I'll get to talking about poetry promotion more generally. Quitting Twitter had absolutely no effect on anything. Being on there had no effect on anything. It was like I clearly wasn't very good at it. I wasn't really using it the way that it was supposed to be used at the time. I also, back in the day, used Facebook to promote the reading series that I ran here in Melbourne, but that was mostly just an informational thing. I wasn't on there having conversations with people, trying to engage. I wasn't doing any of that. It was more just like, hey, the reading's on. This is when it's on. One of the things that most people do to promote themselves and their work is use Instagram. I had an Instagram account in 2013, maybe 14, 15, back when there was no algorithm to speak of. You just got the photos in order that they were posted and you could get to the end of the scroll. The way that it works now, I have young friends who teach me about how it works now, sounds like being hooked up to an intravenous drip of heroin. Like, I don't know how anyone uses it the way that it is set up now and doesn't lose their whole life to it. And people do. People lose like hours and hours and hours to that thing every day. And I really feel for them because I am on Substack, but I've done a lot of things, a lot of weird like muting and blocking to try to get around the addictive nature of it. And I'm still fully addicted to it. I check it like 20 times a day. It's really bad. But yeah, so I just want to sort of like paint the picture of the reality of how I'm using this stuff at the moment, because I did say, oh, I don't touch social media, but I absolutely do and have. The deal that I've made with myself is you can't go on Instagram. Like, I don't want to go on Instagram. I do miss out on heaps of stuff. I miss out on readings and submission opportunities and relationships because I'm not on there, but I'm not willing to pay that price. But yeah, I'm over on Substack and I'm like looking at stuff and stalking people and, trying to like things strategically and being a total fuckhead about it. 'Cause that's like how it, that's what it does to your brain. It makes you think that it's important and that it's going to have some kind of effect. The thing is, like, it really doesn't. It really doesn't have much of an effect, particularly on like book sales, right? Like, I was able to post something a couple of weeks ago when this show went live where I was like, hey, we've got a podcast. And like, people started listening to it. That was really cool. But no one, I'll bet you $100, Jonathan, no one has looked at my Substack that I've been posting on for about a year and gone, oh, wow, Alice Allen's a really good writer. Maybe I'm going to go buy her book, The Empty Show. Like, no one's done that. Not a single person has done that. So it's kind of like, how do you promote yourself without going insane? Well, I think the first thing you have to do is realize that, like, a lot of the activity that you do is actually going to amount to nothing at all.
One thought I have is like when I was living in New York, a group of my friends were involved in making theater. They had their own company and they were creating these wonderful plays, and they weren't getting much of an audience for a lot of them. And one of the things that they told me is that like in off-Broadway theater, the way you sell tickets is by having a larger cast. Because the people who come to see the shows are the friends of the people who are in the shows. I'm oversimplifying, but it's kind of true. And so part of where I struggle with this, part of where I get hung up, goes back to like the walking and chewing gum thing. Because I feel like a lot of how books get sold, and I think maybe there's a little bit of difference between how they get sold and how they get read. But like a lot of how books get sold, I think, is that again, we're in this kind of gift economy. And so we buy each other's books. And so like the more you cultivate relationships, the more those relationships produce sales. And again, I'm oversimplifying, but
No, I don't think you are actually. I think that's like pretty accurate. And when you say it like that, it's like, oof, that's complicated.
yeah, it starts to feel like there's something really dishonest about that. And like, I think people engage in this in ways that are like completely honest. I think there are people who are just like much more natural at being human beings, and like interacting with other people. But I can't help feeling that like there is something instrumentalizing in the way I would be interacting with people. And I know when I was on Facebook, like it was really distorting for me because I was interacting with all these people, in many cases, people I really respected, like writers I really admired. But I think there was always something a little bit dishonest, maybe even dishonest with myself, about what I was doing in those interactions. And I think there are a lot of places where I get hung up, but that's one of the ones.
Yeah, no, I think that's like entirely true for the vast majority of people. Maybe it doesn't feel true, but I would go so far as to say that, yeah, we're all always thinking maybe this will lead to something in the back of our minds when we're having these sorts of interactions. The other part of this, so we've gone straight to like online stuff and social media, but the other part of this for me is the in-person stuff because I live in this city that has a poetry event at least once a week, some weeks every night. And if I were on Instagram, I'd be feeling a lot more pressure to like go to more stuff because I'd know about more stuff. But when I go to in-person events, I feel an extreme pressure to have the right kinds of conversations with the right people in that room. And that is such a gross way to interact with people. Like it's so dishonest and it's so alienating for both parties. but I find it really hard to put it down. And you know, I referenced the other week that I had a really bad time at a poetry reading recently, and it was because I went there not with the intention of like networking so much, but I went because I wanted to try to cultivate a few friendships. And instead, what happened is the people I spoke to kind of very quickly walked away from me because I wasn't particularly interesting to them. And I was left like standing alone in a room. And that's not about like selling my book. That's about like trying to have a human interaction with people. But I guess I just mention it because it feels very messy. It feels extremely messy walking into those rooms and just being like, can I be myself? Should I be myself? If I'm myself, are people just going to be like, oh, cool, all right, see you later.
Yeah,
Bye.
one of the closest I think I've ever come to experiencing what it would be like to be a woman surrounded by like straight men is going to the AWP conference, which is like the big creative writing conference. And like you have these like badges that you wear and they have your name on them. And so just like walking around and just seeing everybody kind of glance at my chest.
Oh my God.
Realize I'm not what they're looking for, and then just move on. Like it's really, it's really remarkable. But like another thing when you're talking about going to readings is I don't go to readings. Like I go to my friends' readings, but like I don't go to a lot of the other readings. And they're like reading series. Like it's not as busy here as it is where you are. But like there are lots of readings and stuff. I don't go to them because I don't like them. Like I have a t I can't. My brain can't keep up. I can't process the poems as fast as they're read. And then like all of my social awkwardness kicks in. And so I've just kind of stopped going to them. And a year from now, I'm going to be giving readings. And I'm going to be asking these people who, run these various readings that I don't go to have me read, and then implicitly asking other people to show up for it. And so, yeah, there's something a little bit maybe dishonest about the ways I would engage with it, but there's something really dishonest about the ways I disengage from it as well.
But that's that what you've just described just completely highlights how silly it all is, right? That gift economy sort of exchange. Because people should come to your reading because you're a good poet and they want to hear what you've written. They shouldn't come because you went to the last six of their readings.
Right, but like, I want people to give me gifts, and I'm not bothering to give other people gifts. Like it's like I'm not presuming. And so like I do think, to the extent that like, this is an economy. Like it's an economy that depends on everybody contributing to it. Like it's kind of like a potluck, and it's really shitty to show up at the potluck with nothing, and then like just start piling shit on your plate. So like I don't know, like I need to start. And it's almost like I've put it off so long, like now it's just like I'm just like s stopping at the store and like buying a box of crackers to bring with me. Because it's so cheap for me to kind of re-engage now.
But it just sucks that we have to frame it that way, right? Like it's just such a shame that that is how it works. Like part of me wants to say to you right now, like, yeah, Jonathan, it might actually be smart if you start going to things because like that might help. But another part of me is just like, no, just if you don't like it, don't go. Like I don't want people to come to my thing just because they're supporting me.
But then I shouldn't show up with a plate. Like I just brought my own bowl, like I shouldn't do that. Like if I'm going to say I don't feel comfortable in this world, I should just not go into the world. And the other thing I want to say, like, because I can easily turn all of my neuroses into an excessive kind of cynicism. There are people who are really happy in that world. There are people who are
Totally.
in there in absolute good faith and enjoying it. So like just because like my relationship to this economy is cynical doesn't mean someone else's is.
Totally. That, I think that's completely fair. There are people who actually just love being at poetry readings and they go to all of the readings and they love.
And they love being around poets, and like all of this is just wonderful.
It's great. And like there's no, if there is consternation, it's not like enough to put them off. Yeah, I mean, you know, this is why when you said, when we had that conversation, I think on Poetry Says, when you said, I just don't love poetry, I was like, oh my God, yeah, I feel exactly the same way. Because it's like, I don't have that, what seems to be a motivation, an intrinsic motivation that people who do love it seem to operate with. They're just like, they want to be there. They always want to be in the room. I never want to be in the room. I was running the room. I didn't want to be in it. For real. Like I ran this reading called Sporting Poets, which I was handed by my poetry mentor, Bonnie. And it was really good for me to do because like the show, it connected me, connected. There's a horrible word. It connected me to a bunch of poets here in Melbourne, and I would do three poets once a month on a Sunday afternoon. Reading kicked off at 5:30. It was done by 6. It's like this the most miniature thing ever. We did it was at a pizza restaurant. Everyone hung around and had pizza afterwards. And I just remember so often feeling not quite miserable, but just like I just didn't care about it. And I just ran it like it was fully a box ticking exercise for me, which is so horrible to say. And there were some nights that were like good and things went well and it felt like, oh, that's nice. We did a cool thing. But most of the time it was just like, yep, done. Okay. When can I go home? I never hung around afterwards. I was the MC and I would just leave at 6:05. I was like, see you later, everybody.
You actually just finished the introductions and left before they
No,
started reading.
fully, fully.
So this is not an episode about readings. This is an episode about promotion. But
Yeah, no, I'm getting us off track.
no, I'm going to take us further off track,
Okay.
or on this track that's off the track. Yeah, there's this thing where like there is a difference between being a good writer of poems and a good reader of poems, and so it's tricky that like our vehicle for promoting books of poems and poetry and everything is readings. I don't know if you're familiar with the poet Ross Gay.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
So every so often I will like give my students a copy of his poem, Catalogue of Unabashed Gratitude, and play a recording of him reciting it. And it's fantastic. Like I think it's a wonderful poem. I think he's often just a really superb poet. And he's also really good at reading the things. And so, like, that's a place where readings are a great idea. If Ross Gay were reading, I probably would go. And like, I'd still deal with all my like social awkwardness, but like, I'd really enjoy the reading. But like, I think in some ways, this economy is a similar version of the problem of the misalignment between good at writing and good at reading, where like, what makes you a good member of the quote unquote community is not necessarily going to overlap with what would make you a good writer of poems. Again, there are people who are both. And so, like, I guess where I find myself going in my head is like, you should probably find some way of contributing. You know, if you're not good at the readings or at the parties, you should probably find something. Because again, like, to go back to the potluck, you just shouldn't show up for the potluck empty-handed if you want to eat.
That's it. Yeah. Actually, yeah. That is, I think that's actually, we might have actually just hit on, you might have actually just hit on some really good advice, Jonathan. Because so I ran that reading and it was hard and bad and I didn't enjoy it. But Making Poetry Says, I did enjoy for the most part. And it was actually the thing that, again, connected me to the rest of Australian poetry. When I went and did this reading the other night, I was introduced by the MC and like He did, you know, it's very unusual for MCs in Australia to do this, but just so happens that this man is American. But he did, like, you know, sort of an off the cuff, like, this person's so great for these reasons sort of introduction. And one of the things he said very kindly was, Alice has introduced more Australian poets to an international audience than anyone else. Like, than anyone else, and then everyone fucking applauded, and I was like, oh my God, that's crazy. But and in that moment I sort of realized, like, oh, I was contributing. It's the thing that's hard for me there is, like, particularly for the last 100 or 50 episodes, I was kind of just off on my own, like, crazy tangent, doing whatever the hell I wanted. And I kind of feel like a lot of people have an idea of what the show was that is actually nothing like what the show is, but that's fine. Like, they seem to think that I was doing this, like, very important, like, historical cataloging work, which I totally wasn't. I was, like, playing pop songs and whinging about my life. But yeah, people have this impression of me through making that show that I have brought, like, quite a large, you know, pot of something to the potluck. So that's nice. And I enjoy doing it. And so yeah, I think there is a strong argument to be made for, like, don't necessarily force yourself to go to the readings or force yourself to be on Substack. Maybe there's another thing you can do that you actually like doing.
Yeah, and the thing that I used to do that I really miss is editing, like actively editing. Like, I mean, selecting was fine. I didn't mind that. But what I did when I was the poetry editor of At Length, alongside all the other things that I was like not doing and failing to do, just like that made it like just eventually feel awful to me, was I was actually editing the poems. Like, I mean, I would, we've talked about it before, like I would get the poet's permission first. I would make sure they were interested in seeing edits. And then, like, in most cases, we would go through like multiple rounds of edits.
That's so nice. Like, no one does that. That's so great.
And like, it was like really exciting for me. Like, it was
Yeah.
something where I could do something that felt valuable, that, you know, people seemed to be grateful for, that was just super interesting to me. I do miss that. You know, and the challenge is like, one of the things that made that work for me is that I was editing poems I had selected. I was editing poems I was already invested in. Like, I really struggle to like figure out what to do with a poem I'm not invested in. I have a hard time imagining how to improve it. That account sort of has run out. Like, I don't want to like you know, try and write some bad checks based on that account. So I would love to figure out something else, some other way of doing that, but I don't have any great ideas for that.
Isn't it also, like, I mean, just to get very sort of practical and mercenary for a second, like, isn't it also that you were Poetry Review's person for Slate for some number of years? You were At Length guy for some number of years. You also have, like, you know, probably quite a few other relationships that are sort of connected to that or not. Like, I don't want to say people owe you
Yeah, they don't.
their attention, but they kind of do. Like, you've done a lot. You've done a lot of things.
I mean, so I'll separate out the reviewing from the editing, because the reviewing feels like I was just handed like a bucket of prestige. Like, and you know, I worked hard and tried to do it well, but like it was such a fucking gift to me in so many ways. And again, like we've talked about this. My friend was just like, "Why don't you write reviews for Slate?" I had no experience reviewing, I had no credentials. There were going to be poetry reviews in Slate, and you know, I have mixed feelings about my approach to reviewing. I think I would be a better reviewer now. I think I have a lot more clarity about what I was doing and what my limitations were. But it was great. It was a great experience. But like, I wasn't like getting rich, but I got paid for those things. And you know, like I always joke that like poetry money is like dog years. You know, you had to multiply it by seven to know what it really is. And like, I was getting all this prestige and attention. So that like that, I don't think I get any credit for doing that. The editing, I feel like nobody was paying me for it. Nobody was like, you know, it was just something I decided to do. And then did for a long time. And so I do feel more kind of proud, I guess, in a way, of that work, even though I have a lot of shame about how the magazine kind of petered out. Unfortunately, these people have come in and taken it over and revived it since. But I don't think anybody owes me for that. And like again, I would be back in the place of feeling gross if I did think about it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bad way of framing it. So much of this conversation is just like icky and awkward. But I mean, it is an exchange. It shouldn't be, but it is in fact an exchange. There is a sense of obligation and what is owed to one another, which does operate. And as you say, some people can come to that in totally good faith and they enjoy it, and others of us don't enjoy it and we feel put upon and we feel stressed. But yeah, it's a strange gift economy that we are working and living and operating in. And there's pretty much no way around that unless you can pull off the move that some poets do pull off, which is to become a recluse. And then you don't have to go to anything. You don't have to contribute anything. And when you show up at the potluck, everyone's like, oh, she's here. That's a cool way to do it.
How do we do that?
I don't know.
Oh, it's disappointing.
It's way too late for me to be a recluse. I'm not going to pull
I think
out.
my mystique is pretty burned up
Yeah,
to
my
it,
mystique is
kind of vaporized.
non-existent. I kind of want to unpack specifically, we use the words going insane. How do you do this without going insane? I sort of want to unpack what specifically it is that makes th that means that this is crazy making. And it is the dishonesty with ourselves and each other. It is the feigned enthusiasm and enjoyment. It's just the lack of integrity between our beliefs and actions, and our feelings and actions. That's crazy
And
making.
that like the going insane is I think, at least for me, just a figure of speech, which I feel vaguely guilty about. It's never made me, it's led to some depression and anxiety here and there, but that's not the thing. It's
It's bad enough, though.
yeah no I don't recommend either of those, but like anyways, what it really is the feeling of dishonesty and the feeling of bad faith and the feeling of loneliness. Those are the things.
Loneliness, yeah.
And degradation, I guess, like feeling insulted. And like, all those things are part of life. But, I think we'd all prefer to feel less degraded and less dishonest and less lonely.
God, yeah. The loneliness part is huge for me.
To bring it back to myself for a minute. So I've got this situation now where I have this book that's coming out. And the other sort of complicating factor is that, like, the people who are involved in publishing this have been really great. My editor's been great. The press has been great. Like, they're just really lovely to work with. And that is great. Like, great is great. But it does, like, it also adds another valence of, like, these people are putting all this effort into this. Like, I really do need to do my fair share. I can't just sit back and be like, you all are great. Go take care of this for me.
If only you were a recluse, then you could do that because they wouldn't
Yes, if
expect
only I
you
was a
to do it.
glamorous recluse.
Yeah.
Yes. So, that's another feeling of like potential assholishness. Like, it's another way in which I would like to not be a prick.
Yeah, and look,
is to just kind of.
I think that's reasonable. I think that is actually, there's a certain level of responsibility you probably do have to your publisher to like do a certain amount of legwork to get the book into people's hands. Like, I think that's, everybody probably should do some version of that, whatever they can stand to do. I don't think any of us can sort of sit back and say, oh, well, my agent will take care of it or my publicist will take care of it for me. Like, we're not. So that's okay. It's just a question of how much activity can you stand to do when it is activity that you enjoy so little. Like, do you think you'll go on like a little tour and like go to New York
Yeah,
and other places?
a friend, a good friend has a book coming out around the same time, and so we're going to do like a little mini tour together.
Oh, that's great.
And like I, yeah, it's that'll be great. Like it'll be great because I mean, spending more time with him, it'll be great because like he's a really great performer. It'll be great in the like off Broadway way of like we'll be, merging our audiences. And I do actually like, speaking of being an asshole, I do like giving readings.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. So, like I probably shouldn't tell this story, but I'm going to tell it anyways. Years and years and years ago, I had a relative who was getting married. The marriage had to be put together really quickly because the other person in the marriage, their father was dying, and they really wanted to get married before he died. And so this marriage got thrown together really quickly. And so I was like going to like I was supposed to write something for the ceremony. One other person was going to write something for the ceremony, and that person was a friend of the other person in the marriage, whose friend was like this super famous writer, like
Oh.
super famous writer. And that guy was also like an ordained minister, and the dying father was a minister. And so they were going to have her dying father do the ceremony. And the famous author was clearly so bothered by the fact that he
What?
wasn't conducting the ceremony,
What?
that like at the rehearsal, he was just in agony. Like he couldn't. And so he like stayed until like he'd done his, and like this may be me misremembering, but I really think during the ceremony that he may have left after he did his part. And his part was great. Like he was a great showman. It was very impressive. But I kind of don't remember seeing him during the rest of the ceremony. So that stuck with me. And I'm not a famous writer, and I'm not an ordained minister. But yeah, I kind of prefer it on the spot for all of my like supposed anxiety and awkwardness. I kind of really like it when the spotlight's on me.
It's nice. It's nice. Yeah, look, I don't know. This is just it's an equation. It's just like how much can you put in? Because you do have to put something in, unless you're a glamorous recluse, you have to put something in. How much can you put in before you hit your limit and you start to feel really anxious and really depressed? And one of the hard things about this, for me at least, is that I don't necessarily know when I'm going to hit that limit. You know, I went to this reading the other night feeling optimistic and happy and good. And I came home and cried and said to Tom, I don't want to do this anymore. I hate this. It's not worth it. You know, blah, blah, blah. Like lately is the closest I've ever come. Not to giving up poetry, but to understanding the people who do. I've just been like, this is so much horrible effort for so little reward. And I'm just like, am I really gonna keep doing this? I just, wow, this is feeling really, really hard now. And I do think forward to if I manage to get a second manuscript together and I managed to get it past a publisher and out into the world, like, what will that moment look like when it is a real book that people can buy? I suspect what it will look like is I will have a relatively nice evening with some friends. Maybe even I'll have one of those in Sydney with a smaller group of people. And then it'll sit around on bookshop shelves for like a 6 months to a year. Maybe it'll get one review, and that will be the end of that. And I'm okay with all of those things, and I don't think I deserve more than that. It's just there are some days where you sort of look at that as the prize, and you go, I don't want to go to this reading tonight. Why would I bother?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it is an economy, and it is something that you need to contribute to. And I think I was lucky that I hit upon the idea of doing a podcast because I absolutely love podcasts. I love making them, I love listening to them. And when I started that show, I had a completely different idea of what I wanted the show to be about. And then I just ended up going, oh, well, let's just do it about poetry because that's, I want to work in this world and may as well just do a poetry podcast. And then it ended up becoming this way that I could be contributing and in conversation with everybody without having to do a lot of the other stuff that was really, really uncomfortable. I love having one-on-one conversations with people, but I suck at having conversations with more than one person, and particularly all those cliches about small talk being hard and all that sort of stuff. Like, that's all very true for me. But when I got to sit down with people and mic them up and say, okay, so tell me about a thing, I felt very safe and confident and like I was in my element. But I don't do that anymore. So, yeah,
Yeah,
there's going to be fewer people at this party.
as you were talking, I've been thinking about this podcast, this thing we're making, where we've kind of decided not to invite other people in,
No, no.
in some ways, like without the money equation, because we're giving this away, which I'm grateful for, I feel like I'm kind of doing a version of the thing where like I'm putting this other thing out in the world. I'm like, oh, and I have this other thing. Can you make time for this too? We talked a little bit when we were thinking about this, about you had suggested maybe we try and coincide it with when my book comes out. And I just felt like an immediate reaction against that, because I do want to make the best thing I can make. And I knew if I was doing it in the context of the book coming out, that like if it had become a marketing thing,
Yeah, you'd be too in
which
your
it still
head.
kind of is, but yeah, that it would just get in the way of that, which brings us back to where I started. You just try and make the best thing you can, and then you have to figure out all this other shit.
Well, yeah, exactly. You just try to make the best thing you can. And like, yes, this is advice from an unknown poet, the podcast you're listening to right now. Like, it's kind of a marketing ploy in a way. Like, we kind of want our names to be in your mind to a degree. But like that is probably like 20th on the list of the reasons I care about making a show such as this. I mean, we had a lovely email from a previous listener to Poetry Says and a listener to this show who said that she had listened to an episode and she had laughed and cried and talked to a therapist about it. And I was like, oh my God, that's the best fucking feeling. Like, there's nothing, no amount of book sales to me, because I mean, what the fuck is a book sale when it comes to poetry? Like, no amount of like that's the thing that matters to me, is I managed to connect with you as you are listening to this, and you felt a little bit better in this shitty, stressful, unrelenting world that we have to live in. I got to be a tiny little bright spot in your day because I was doing the thing that I like doing anyway. That's the greatest.